The pillars, roof, and walls were of a turquoise blue, and beyond this was a great hall of white quartz. "See the gold?" said Beryl, and, sure enough, there were veins of gold and other metals running through the quartz. Now, the first three halls seemed the work of nature only, but the pillars here had evidently been cut into their present shape by some intelligent agent. They were not highly finished, but they were evidently cut square, and not natural. On the left was an arched doorway, and Beryl murmured, "The door leads to the place where the gnomes and dwarfs live. I've never been there."
"Why not?"
I inquired. "We're afraid to," they answered together. "They mightn't let us out again, you see."
"What do they do?"
I continued. "They get the gold and jewels out of the earth, and make beautiful things. The fairies say they have such lovely palaces in there, but we've never been there." They seemed rather frightened lest the gnomes should catch them, so we hurried on. Roof, floor, and walls were all of the same material, but it was not always white. Some pillars were pink, and some green or blue. At length I saw a star of light, and, as we approached it, the phosphorescent light gave place to daylight. As we continued our journey, I heard the tinkle of falling water, and presently found a little stream running down one side of the passage near the left-hand wall. At length we saw ferns, and in another moment were out of the cave. The little stream fell in a miniature cascade over the rocks into the valley below, where it formed a broad pool in a natural basin made of marble. A natural stairway led down into this valley, but before we went down it, we paused to admire the view. It was a glorious one, hills and valleys covered with trees, many of them in flower, stretched as far as we could see in every direction. Graceful ferns edged the waterfall, and bulrushes quivered in a slight breeze at the edge of the pool. We descended the natural stairway, and the grass was covered with all manner of wild flowers which on earth are found at different seasons of the year. Bushes, covered with wild roses, overhung the pool, and at their feet nestled violets and primroses. A little further off, under some tall oak trees, were wood anemones and bluebells. Harebells and corncockles grew side by side among the tall grass of a rolling meadow, while poppies were everywhere, throwing up by contrast daisies of all descriptions, buttercups, and charlock. I won't give you a botanical list, for I have given you sufficient to indicate the profusion of blossoms. The air was laden with the scent of the honeysuckle and wild thyme, and I bent forward to pluck some of the former. But Joyce screamed out, "You mustn't, it's the home of a fairy." Even as she was speaking, something flew in my face and tweaked my nose viciously. I instinctively put up my hands to brush it off, but it flew out of sight in an instant. Next moment I felt a sharp prick in my ankle and then saw a tiny figure dive into the rosebud. I had hardly time to get over my surprise when I felt several sharp tugs at my hair, and next instant my hat went splash into the pool. "The fairies are angry with you," said Beryl, "for wanting to pluck the flowers. How can I quiet them?" I began, but the rest of my speech was cut off by a fly in my nose. I sneezed, and another tiny creature tumbled to the ground. It seemed none the worse, for it scampered out of sight behind a dock leaf. "Let's sing to them," said Joyce, and they sang, "Up the airy mountain, down the rushy glen." As the song proceeded, the fairies ceased to plague me, and began to appear in the mouths of the flowers. From every harebell little figures dressed in blue appeared. Pink and white fairies nestled amid the leaves of the rosebuds, or swung on the twigs and leaves. A primrose at my feet suddenly became alive with little beings, and even the grasses seemed to have their fairy inhabitants. I looked at my cap, and was surprised to see gay little watermen in white and yellow liveries scrambling into it from the water lilies. They plucked spear-shaped leaves from some of the water plants, in spite of the angry protests of little green fairies who pushed several of them into the water. But the water lily fairies did not mind in the least. They laughed and gurgled, and climbed back into my hat, and at length, having got a full load, they began to paddle it about the pond like a boat. Perhaps it was too heavy for them, for they soon got tired of this amusement, and abandoned it when it bumped into a small rock near one side of the pool. I recovered it, little the worse for its strange adventure,
and am not surprised that they found it difficult to manage, for they had to get on the top of the sides to ply their tiny oars, and usually fell off in the process. They were too small to see over the sides if they stood up in the bottom of the cap. The fairies were of almost every type and were more or less human in shape, but of the tiniest size. Some had wings, but many had not. All were dressed in a color derived from the flowers they inhabited, but often they had a little green about them, corresponding to the shade of the green of the leaves of the plant to which they belonged. Some, I said just now, had wings, and these were of almost every conceivable shape. Some were shaped like those of butterflies, the coloring being similar to that of their dress. Others had semi-transparent wings, like dragonflies, which sparkled like gems, some opalescent, others silver-white, red, blue or green. Another group were more like different kinds of flies, and later I came across the larger fairies with bat-like wings, these two being colored red, green, and blue, and so forth, not dull browny black, as bats' wings are on Earth. The forms of their bodies likewise varied enormously, although all the flower fairies were distinctly human in shape, but while some were dainty, slender, graceful little creatures, others were short and fat with rather ugly, comical faces, just like the brownies of the nursery books. Their clothes puzzled me a good deal, for they seemed to be partly themselves and also partook of the nature of the flowers they inhabited. But at the same time they were not part of their bodies, like the fur of an animal is, but real garments. For example, many of them had queer little caps on their heads. One other point. The prettier fairies were those who lived in the prettier flowers, such as the rose, while the funny little brownies belonged to the humbler weeds and grasses as a rule. Well, by the time the children had finished their song, the fairies had quite forgotten their earlier animosity to me, and seemed to ignore me altogether, but some had made a big ring round Beryl and Joyce, and began to dance round them, singing a pretty little song in their shrill, tiny voices, which reminded me irresistibly of the chirping of insects. But they never finished it, for suddenly three brownies came with a hop, skip and jump into the circle, and next minute there was a perfect scrimmage, which ended almost as soon as it had begun, and then the whole party dashed down to the pond and began to get into leaves and into acorn cups, in which they paddled about by means of paddles made from the leaves of couch grass. Joyce shook her finger at me, "Don't you ever do that again," meaning try to pick the flowers, and I promised humbly to remember. We walked towards the wood, and, as we went, my ear caught the sound of someone weeping. Looking down, I saw a violet fairy shedding bitter tears. Beryl said to the poor little thing, "What's the matter, then?" And the little creature answered, "My sister's dead. See how still she lies." We looked, but could see nothing but a dead violet. "But," I said, "I can see no fairy, only a dead violet." "Yes, but the violet is dead because my sister has gone. Can you not fetch her back?" I asked soothingly. She gazed open-eyed at me for a moment, and then said, "You stupid thing. The flower is dead, so how can I fetch her back? She would have no home if I could, and, of course, I cannot." And at once she fell to weeping again. One or two fairies glanced at her for a moment, but none stopped to try and comfort her. They were too busy about their own amusements, and, as we could say nothing to console her, we stole quietly away on tiptoes. "Poor little violet," said Beryl. "I wonder where the spirits of the fairies go." And I answered, "I, too, wonder." He paused for a moment and then said, "Well, Jack, I think I'll break off there," for we next entered the wood which led into a regular forest, and many of the fairies there were different from the flower fairies. But you see, even in fairyland there is some sorrow. J.W. But for the most part, I imagine, they spend their time happily enough. R.L.W. Yes, in laughter and jest, irresponsible little people as a rule, and I think when they grow serious and learn what sorrow means they are on the road which leads to the earth. Perhaps Violet, the fairy, is already being born as a real violet on earth. If so, I hope her sister will be growing on the same route, but I wonder whether she will have intelligence enough to re-one-eyes it. I asked the children, but I don't think they understood me. Anyway, they gave me no satisfactory answer. He ceased, and as it was evident that he would not renew the conversation, I said goodbye, and returned to Earth, wondering what had become of the two violets. Chapter 18. The Battle Between the Oak and the ASH. January 7th and 8th, 1918. As soon as I had settled down, RLW took up his narrative where he had left it last week. As we approached the wood, Beryl said, "Don't trust the ash or the alder. They hate all men." "Why, I don't know. They are horrid things. They can't hurt us, though," I said. "I don't know, but we're afraid of them," she replied, and we said no more on the subject. As we advanced further into the wood, I noticed that both the flowers and the flower fairies grew fewer and fewer. The light too grew less, and I became aware of strange shadows that seemed to flit from tree to tree, and glided noiselessly near us. If ever I turned round to look at them fully, I could see nothing, but if I went on and appeared not to notice them, I caught glimpses of them out of the corner of my eyes. After a time this began to get on my nerves, and I said to the children, "What are those shadows?" Joyce answered, "They are the fairies who live in the trees and the shrubs, at least some of them are. But what the others are we don't know. Perhaps they are fairies who live in rocks and streams." "Can you tell the difference between the two kinds?" I asked her. "Not easily," she replied. "They are all so shy, except the oak and the beech. They love us, and sometimes talk to us." Suddenly I heard a voice speaking, and it seemed to me from a big oak tree. "Yes, I love men. Sit down and talk to me." So we sat down under the spreading boughs of the oak tree and it continued, "Who are you?" Meaning me, RLW. "The children I know well, and have often talked with them before. But you are new to this place." So I told him briefly, and he said, "Ha! A warrior. I long to be a warrior and to deal lusty strokes. To beat down the evil creatures who cross my path. To help and protect the weak from those who would ill-treat them. Above all I would like to break down every ash tree I see." "Why do you hate the ash?" I inquired. "Because he is evil." "Do you not hate him?" "You should, for he hates you, and so does the alder, and the deadly nightshade that fawns upon them. He hates the rose. Do you see how he tries to strangle her? So does the ash. I think he hates all the plants. See how they shun him. How often do you find any growing under his branches? Do you know that if any do, he drops poison upon them from his branches? He is an evil tree, and I hate him. Can't you come out of the tree and talk to me more closely?" I asked. He laughed a jolly, blustering laugh. "I will, my young friend." Next moment, in front of us, stood a tall, strapping fellow. He reminded me of the statues of young Hercules rather than those of the dryads, as I expected would be the case. But instead of a lion skin he had what appeared to be a cloak of leaves matted together, but draped very much as one might drape a skin around one's body. One shoulder and breast were bare, as were his legs from halfway above the knees. In his right hand he bore a heavy club, and his head was crowned with oak leaves, with acorns in place of jewels. He swung his club lightly in the air, and shouted for joy. The muscles of his arms and thighs stood out like ropes, and he towered over me. I stood up so as to get some idea of his size, and he must have been at least 9 feet high, and broad in proportion. Suddenly his face grew set and stern, and he swung sharply round and sprang into the open. I looked in the same direction and perceived at once the cause of the change. A tall, lanky being was gliding towards him. Not so tall as the oak, being about 7 feet 6 inches high, yet its very thinness made it appear taller than it really was. It was a dull greyish white in color, whereas the oak was ruddy red-brown. It had excessively long arms, which hung well down below its knees, and which, like the rest of its body, were long and unpleasant looking. But its face, it was like that of a dead corpse, save that its eyes were almond-shaped, and set at an unnaturally acute angle. Its mouth was floppy and shapeless, more like the mouth of a leech than of anything human. It was naked save a loincloth of ash leaves, and these told me what it was, even before I heard the frightened whisper of the children. "The ash! The ash!" He held in his hand a spear made of a pointed ash stake, and I noticed his hands, which were almost as bony as those of a skeleton, had nails like the talons of a bird. Suddenly I heard a shrill unpleasant voice call out, "There they are, master," and I perceived that there followed the ash, like a jackal follows a tiger, a repulsive little beast who, I knew by instinct, was the spirit of the deadly nightshade. It was not more than 3 feet tall, and more like a spider than a man. It was an ugly green, not the pretty green of grass or oak leaves, but a most repulsive color difficult to describe. Its body was small, with purple and yellow patches, but its arms and legs, which were out of all proportion, were green. It could not walk properly, but sprawled and shuffled along, often using its hands to help its progress. It had orange-colored eyes in its small, misshapen head, and in its hands carried a lariat of green tendrils and stalks woven together, and evidently made from the trails of the deadly nightshade. At intervals this lariat was decorated with bright scarlet beads. Neither of the great protagonists had spoken as yet, but now the ash cried out in a harsh, grating voice, "Give them to me, all three of them. What right have they here?" "Give them to you," roared back the oak, in a perfect paroxysm of fury. "If I once get a chance, I'll smash you to pieces, and your miserable servant too." Without another word he sprang at the ash. Seeing a fight about to take place on our behalf, I sprang at one of the boughs of the oak which sheltered us, and tore off one of its boughs. The latter came away readily in my hand. It was not rotten, but a stout piece of wood. Rather it seemed as if a good tree gave it to us willingly. Rapidly I broke off the twigs, and found myself with a stout cudgel about 3.5 feet long in my hands. I then looked at the two spirit trees, for all this had taken but a moment to do. The oak struck at the ash, who nimbly leapt aside and as he did so, smote at the oak. The latter's club had struck the ground harmlessly, but the spear of the ash hit the oak full on the right breast. His robe of oak leaves, however, seemed like a cuirass of steel, for the point of the spear glanced off harmlessly. The oak recovered himself, and aimed a smashing blow at the ash, who caught it on his left arm, and gave an agonizing howl. The limb seemed to be broken, but at the same moment there was a flash of scarlet and green, and next instant the brave oak was caught by the lariat of the deadly nightshade. The rope was too wide to hold on his shoulders, but slipped and tightened round his arms and chest, preventing him striking again, as the little green beast pulled it taut. At once I dashed into the rescue, despite the frightened shrieks of the children. Now the deadly nightshade was defenseless, for his lariat was round the oak, but the ash saw the danger, for he ran to meet me with his spear raised to strike. I struck it aside, and we passed each other not a foot apart. I turned at once and landed the nightshade a stout blow on his left arm, which he had raised to cover his head. The blow sent him sprawling, and he loosened his grip on the lariat. I heard a roar from the oak, and knew that he was shaking himself free of the green rope which bound him, but I had not time to look in his direction, for the next moment the ash was on me again, and I felt a sharp pain in my left thigh. He had transfixed me. For a moment I saw his baleful, evil eyes gloating over me, then heard a sickening thud, followed by the splintering of wood, and the grey shadow seemed to burst. The good oak had struck home, but I had no time to see anything further, for the next instant the long arms and bony fingers of the deadly nightshade were about my neck, trying to throttle the life out of me. I don't suppose he could have done it, for, after all, I am an astral being, not a fairy, and so not amenable to their laws, but in any case, there was no opportunity of settling the matter, for next instant the little brute was torn from my throat, and I saw the oak holding him in the air by one of his legs. He squirmed and wriggled like an eel, and in his struggles tore the oak leaf crown from the giant's head. I tried to struggle to my feet, but the spear, which was still in my thigh, prevented my doing so. The next moment the deadly nightshade was dashed to the ground, but one of his arms, still holding the oak's brown locks, was torn from its socket and hung dangling idiotically in the air. But the little green brute seemed as if made of rubber, for he bounced up again, and raced off into the forest far faster than I should have thought possible. His remaining arm was broken, and his right foot, with which he had torn the crown from the oak's head, was still entangled with it. This proved his undoing, for he tripped and fell sprawling. In an instant the oak was upon him. The club flashed in the air for a moment, and descended with a thud. There was a squashing sound, difficult to describe, and soon there was only a heap of green pulp. Finally, the young giant stamped on the remaining arm, which had fallen from his head at last, and then returned to me. He drew the spear from my thigh, and was loud in praise of my heroism in coming to his help, but I could not respond appropriately, for I felt sick with pain. It seemed as if there was some poison in the wound. On realizing this, the oak said, "Let us go back to the beech tree. She will soon make you well." The two children, who appeared badly scared, joined us, and as we went I looked for the remains of the ash, but could see none except a few scattered leaves, which must have once formed his dress. "That was a great fight," said the oak, joyfully. "There will be one less ash in the forest now. I wish I could kill them all at one blow, but there are so many." At length we came to a noble beech tree, I limping painfully. "Ho, Lady Beech, may we have some of your leaves to dress this young hero's wounds? He helped to slay the ash and the deadly nightshade, but the ash has wounded his thigh. Give us your leaves to heal it," and the beech waved its boughs, as a soft, gentle voice murmured, "Take them, poor lad. I hope he will soon be well." So the little girls plucked bunches of leaves, and made a poultice of them, and as soon as it was laid on, my wound ceased to pain me. While this was being done, the oak related to the beech all that had occurred, and when he had finished, and my wound was dressed, she said, "Let him rest under the shelter of my boughs, and I will talk to him, and soon his limb will be healed." So we all three rested there, but the oak went back to his tree, singing lustily. "But I think you have been here long enough, so I will break her off here." At which I, J.W., said goodbye, and departed. Chapter 19, The Beech Tree. January 14th to 15th, 1918. As soon as I had greeted all three, R.L.W. began, we sat under the beech tree for some time, while the lady of the beech talked to us and told us many strange tales of the doings of the alder and the ash. According to her story, there was an unholy alliance between these two. From what I could make out, it was seldom that human beings ever came their way, though they were filled with a deadly hatred of mankind, and so for the most part they vented their spite on the flower fairies and on the weaker trees, such as the elder. One part of the beech's conversation I will give you in full. "Some of us at times descend to earth, while still retaining our fairy powers, and dwell there for a season. Some of the ash and alder spirits do this, and while they are ever ready to work their evil will on any wayfarer. But of course, this is our real home, until the time when we depart to return no more." "How many orders of fairies are there?" I, R.L.W., inquired. "Many, many orders. How many I do not know, but these are some of them: the flower fairies, the gnomes, who dwell in the earth, and delve for gold and gems; the tree spirits, the spirits of earth, air, fire, and water, generally; the fairy folk, and above all, the high fairies." "What do you mean by the last two types of fairies?" I, R.L.W., asked her. She seemed troubled at this question, and the boughs of the tree waved mournful one. "Why, the high fairies are the high fairies. I do not know how to explain what I mean so that you can understand me. They are above all other fairies, and even I have seldom seen them. They are so, oh so beautiful and bright, and their colors are ever changing. Perhaps you will see them. Then you will understand. As to the fairy folk, they are much like men, and live in houses and cities, and have kings and queens to reign over them. If you journey on beyond the further edge of the forest, you will doubtless come to them." R.L.W. "And where shall I see the fire fairies, and the others of earth, air, and water?" The boughs rustled as if she were laughing, and she replied, "Why, they are everywhere. Every stream, on earth, as here in fairyland, has its water sprite. Many of the gnomes are earth spirits, though indeed, there are greater earth spirits than these. As to the fire spirits, They are the servants of the god of fire and do his bidding. I started at this, as you may well guess. Is there, then, a god of fire? Apostrophes, of a truth, and many other gods. Did you not know it? I hesitated, and said, no, I thought there was only one god. She waved her boughs, as she answered softly. There is but one god, yet he works through many gods and spirits and men and animals. He shows his power and his majesty in all that is or was or shall be. For all that was is, and all that shall be was, and in him all things are. A great stillness passed over the forest now, and it was some time before I plucked up enough courage to ask her, is he in the ash, then, and the alder? Yes, truly, even in the ash, who, doubtless, has his work to do. But what is the work of the ash? Nay, I am but a poor beech tree, or the spirit thereof, as you like. How then, can I know what is his intent? But doubtless it is good. But what has happened to the spirit of the ash whom the oak slew? That I can tell you. He has passed down to your earth, and even now a young ash tree is growing somewhere in which he dwells, but after that has perished I cannot tell you what will happen to him, but certainly his spirit will not perish. And as to the spirits of the air, they, too, are everywhere. In the air which you find on earth, but also elsewhere, according to their station they have their part in the universe. Man is not the only spirit, either on earth, on this plane, or the next. So, I said, you know of what we call the spirit plane? I have heard of it, she replied, but know little of it. She ceased, and at length I rose and signed to the children, but before we went I said to the lady of the beech tree, will you not show us yourself? We have heard your voice, but have not seen you. Here I stand, she cried, and there, at the foot of the beech tree, stood a beautiful lady. A little taller than human she seemed, but perfectly proportioned, and I noticed her hair fell almost to the ground. It was brown in color, and she wore a green robe, exactly the color of the beech leaves, but shot here and there with delicate threads of bronze. Her face I cannot describe to you, but it was very beautiful. Goodbye, and beware of the alder. She, too, looks fair, at first. And so saying, she vanished as suddenly as she had appeared. I turned to the children. Shall we go further into fairyland? Beryl at once said, yes, do let us. It is so nice here, isn't it? So we started on once more. But now you must return to earth, Jack. So I returned. Chapter 20, The Fairy Folk. January 21, 1918. As soon as I saw RLW he continued, we journeyed on, seeing various fairy forms flitting past us in the forest, but we saw no sign of the alder. As we went, we came to the splintered fragments of an ash tree. And Joyce said, that must have been the ash which the oak killed. Near it was a crushed and broken deadly nightshade, and I knew that the child was right. On we journeyed, until we came at length to the edge of the forest, and passed out into smiling fields, where I saw little houses, and further off, across a river, a city with shining domes. Not far away was a castle, yes, a regular medieval castle, and clustering round it were cottages. We went towards this castle, and were suddenly stopped by a shrill, piping voice, and, looking round, saw a queer old woman standing at her door. She was dressed in an old-fashioned dress, such as one sees in the pictures of nursery tales of the old crone. I turned to her, and said in my best fairy book style, good morrow, dame. Where do you come from, and where are you going? She asked, promptly. We are mortals, or were mortals, I replied, for we are dead, and now are exploring fairyland. Yes, I can see that, but how did you get here? That's what I want to know, she inquired sharply. Joyce explained briefly, and she then said, well, as you are here, I suppose you deserve to be here. What is your name? I inquired. I haven't one as yet, but someday I shall, I expect, when the children discover me, but so few of them believe in fairies now, and so only those who have already been discovered long ago when everybody believed in us have a name. Perhaps you will teach these silly mortals that there are such things as fairies, after all. I promised to do so, and she went in, saying as she did so, I should call at the castle, If I were you. We reached the castle without further incident. It was surrounded by a broad moat, and on a tree, opposite the gate, hung a silver horn. Blow the horn, said Beryl, and let's see what will happen.